time for the Packet Pushers Podcast.
When too much networking would be barely enough.
Rooters, witches, firewalls,
a podcast on the data networking industry. Rooting, switching, design, strategies, daily work life, or whatever we find interesting. Whatever it is, we'll talk about it. Are you ready?
Welcome to the Packet Pushers Podcast. This is part two and the conclusion of show number 21, where Greg and Ethan talk about deploying IPv6 with Matt Ryanzak of Aaron and Jan Bavar of NIL. If you missed part one of this show, you'll want to head over to packetpushers.net and give it a listen. Without further ado, let's jump right back into the conversation. So with the basic connectivity there, we kind of have an idea of what's replaced ARP now and whether or not we need DHCP and the options there and a host name to IP address mapping or IPv6 address mapping and how that all works. The next thing is, all right, how do we get this IPv6 traffic around the network? Now, most of us that are going to be building out IPv6 networks are saying, I have to have an IPv4 network that remains as my production environment. Slowly, I'm going to layer in my IPv6 as time goes on, meaning you're going to have routers and clients and so on, but routers and switches particularly running a dual stack, IPv4 to support the production environment as it's been for probably a long time, and then IPv6 as you begin to build out that infrastructure. Now, one of the thoughts that pops into my head, I'm going to be turning on a whole set of new features in my router and or switch in my data centers and at my WAN edge. Are there risks associated with that when you start going dual stack on say a Cisco router?
Well, one thing is that people in the past, let's say 10 years, they have forgotten what a multi-protocol network looks like. I think we're all running IP, and people forget that we used to run DECnet, we used to run AppleTalk, all that stuff, and the ships in the night concept is kind of forgotten. We rediscovered this because, okay, we still run multi-protocol networks for some of our customers, but with IPv6, we discovered that we played with it quite a lot in even, let's say, production or half-production environments, and we never actually broke anything because this ships in the night concept really works. And this is the same thing as we were used to. Like, if there's a DECnet problem, it rarely affects IP unless there's a layer 2 or a physical problem. So in fact, you will typically see surprisingly little influence of one protocol to the other, and we were again pleasantly surprised. Of course, if you turn on a certain feature which crashes the whole router, that's another story. But in terms of, let's say, changing the settings, changing addresses, changing the routings, those protocols are completely ships in the night. And it's important to realize that IP and V4 and IPv6 are basically quite orthogonal in the network and do not really influence each other. We have, for example, one case with the firewall doing basically we configured both IPv4 and IPv6 failover on a pair of firewalls, and while the IPv6 code went completely crazy and the whole thing just fell apart, IPv4 was still working perfectly on the same boxes, basically taking different paths through the code. So again, in our experience, it has been a really, I think, a proof that multi-protocol networks really do separate their protocols well.
And IPv6 has been around in iOS for quite a while. I'm not sure how many years do you, Jan? Yeah.
It's been around forever. Although some features, again, the problem is Cisco can put stuff in iOS very early, and then nobody uses that except a couple of networks, perhaps. And then as new users are coming in, you discover new bugs and so on, and then they start porting features to, let's say, faster switching paths and so on. So I would say, yeah, the IPv6, the core software has been around for a long time. But for example, features like NAT PT, not NAT port and address translation, basically they were probably abandoned because somebody figured out that you will never be able to use this in real life, or this will actually never work in real life. But this was only found, let's say, last year or this year perhaps. So while it is true that some features have been around for a long time, it doesn't mean that they were tested in all the environments. And as new users are coming in now, new things are being found, certain technologies are being abandoned, new technologies are being thought of. So I would say I wouldn't call it mature, for example. We had, for example, one very obvious problem in iOS, and that was there was no support of IPv6 on a BVI interface, so a bridged virtual interface. Mm-hmm. So, for example, a very common use case when you have, let's say, a home office, when you have people using a wireless network, and connecting to the internet and also using the local LAN. So you decide to bridge the wireless network to the local LAN to make it one VLAN, let's say. There's no way to create a local gateway. There was no way to create a local default gateway on that VLAN because a BVI interface could not be IPv4 addressed. So you'd have to like separate those into two VLANs, one for the wireless network, one for the wired network. And this was fixed, for example, let's say 6 months ago or let's say last year perhaps. And that's a pretty obvious feature, like a BVI interface. We use that quite a lot in a lot of scenarios, but again, it didn't make it into iOS because nobody actually requested it. So you would, again, features which you would expect to work then turn out to be not yet supported or simply not working.
Now, Matt, you mentioned you were running IPv6 on some of the Aaron systems. I mean, is like Windows or Mac OS? I mean, I know on my Windows 7 box, if I do an ipconfig/all, I'm going to see a number of IPv6 addresses that are sitting there ready and waiting for me to use, in addition to the IPv4 that I use all the time. Have you guys had much IPv6 rollout within the Aaron Enterprise network, so to speak?
Yes, we have. So we deployed the first V6 on the Aaron network in 2003, I believe. We'd been playing with it since around 2002 or so. And that included deploying it on some Linux hosts and some Windows hosts at the time. And today, if you're on our wireless network or if you're on our internal client network here at the Aaron offices, you're dual stack. You get a V4 and a V6 address. So we've actually got quite a lot of experience using everything from Windows XP to Linux to Apple. I have a Linux workstation and a Mac laptop. Both work with V6 just great. Windows 7, as you mentioned, it just works with V6. It supports all V6 features. It works really well. And even old OSs like Windows XP have limited support for V6, but certainly functional support for V6. We have a lot of XP workstations still that we're in the process of migrating this year to Windows 7. And it has the peculiar feature, I guess you could call it, of supporting V6, however, not being able to do DNS lookups over IPv6, which is kind of strange. However, it happens to work really well in the dual stack environment. So as long as they have V4 name servers that they can use, they'll speak V6 just fine for doing, whatever, surfing the web or SSH or whatever we need them to do.
Not any of the little limitations like that are there now. Over time, those are going to get engineered out by the vendors.
Yeah, and if Microsoft solved that with Windows 7, and actually Windows Vista also had really good IPv6 support. So if you're using the modern Microsoft stuff, it frankly things they just work. In fact, V6 with Windows 7 can kind of work too well in that you have Teredo and other transition mechanisms that Microsoft has built in that will just work. You may have V6. And not even know it. It's kind of cool. OSX, it has similar things as well as far as transition technologies go.
I'm noticing when I do Wireshark sniffs these days that there's a lot of IPv6 just going out on the wire, and I haven't bothered to try to track it down to see what all the sources are. But I know a bunch of it is going to come back to Windows 7 devices that are out there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, all right. So, I mean, it seems doable, seems plausible. The technology's there for most of us. Probably the routers and switches, if nothing else, with an upgrade, are going to be able to support it, and a lot of us are going to have OSs on our networks that can do it. What about exchanging routes between routers? I mean, Cisco will offer you OSPF, and many other vendors are going to offer you OSPF v3. You can run EIGRP for IPv6. Is there preferred protocol to use, or is it the same same argument that we have in the IPv4 world, where it's use what you want? If you want maximum interoperability, use OSPF.
Yeah, I would say that the rules are really the same. At Aaron, we of course use BGP to talk to external networks and arrange that routing. Internally, we run OSPF, and we really didn't change anything when we started implementing IPv6. The configuration is about the same. The addresses look different, but the functionality and the configuration for the most part is the same. There is some differences with OSPF, but for the most part, if you figured out how to do it in V4, you're not going to have a hard time figuring out how to do it on V6. That's been our experience anyways.
Now, you mentioned BGP externally, which, of course, will do V4 prefixes and V6 as well. If I'm sitting at my Cisco router and I've done my router BGP and put in an ASN number, what are my next steps to get that router ready to talk IPv6?
Well, you have to decide how you want to speak to your neighbors over V4 or over V6, because you can exchange V6 routes over either of those transports. So, for example, we mostly use V6 transport. So we basically just configure a V6 neighbor and very simply just advertise networks, receive networks, and filter out stuff. So just the same, exactly the same approach as in the V4 world, except, again, you have to decide whether you want to use two transports, so different BGP sessions over V6 and V4, or just a single V4 session or a single V6 session for the entire exchange.
I mean, would you do it over a V4 session just because that was your only option? Logically, to me, if you're going to the point of talking to an external neighbor for the purpose of exchanging IPv6 routes, you might as well do that over an IPv6 transport. Is it kind of a common thing where you got to do it over IPv4?
Now, I would recommend using V6 because perhaps your V4 connectivity still works and your V6 local connectivity has somehow disappeared and you would still be receiving the prefixes, although you cannot reach your neighbor or something like this. So I would really prefer using V6 to ensure that V6 connectivity to your neighbor works to be properly able to forward traffic to that particular neighbor. Otherwise, again, I don't see a point in talking V4 unless your router is, for example, has already like hundreds of BGP sessions and you don't want to really burden it with additional TCP processing. But I would probably say go with the logical native choice. Use the same transport as the networks you're advertising or receiving.
No, Matt, when you and Jan were talking earlier, you both kind of alluded to the fact that not every ISP is going to be able to give you IPv6. And I'm kind of curious, do we even have a globally connected IPv6 internet at this point? Or is it really you've got kind of islands or pockets of IPv6 that you may need to have to hit IPv4 to connect those two points?
So to answer your question, there is definitely a global IPv6 internet. There are at least three and I think four Tier 1 networks that have V6 backbones that span the globe.
Who's got them?
NTT is an example of one. TINET, which used to be Tiscali, is another. I think Level 3 at this point also has a V6 backbone. Most of the big providers out there, including people like Verizon, if they don't have it, if they don't have big signs on their front door saying they have V6 enabled on their backbone, they probably have it anyways. It's just not well known or well advertised at this point.
May or may not be customer ready, but probably there. And maybe if you start asking your salespeople, you might be able to get IPv6 if you want it.
Oh, absolutely. Here at Aaron, we're in somewhat of a special position. I mean, one, we're a registry, so we don't have a problem getting V6 addresses, obviously, things like that. But we also have good relationships with a lot of ISPs, so we can ask them more directly without going through salespeople what their offerings are. But also, we're located in a really good area. We're a few miles down the road from Ashburn, Virginia, which has a huge presence of Equinix and other big data centers and exchanges and stuff like that. So we're able to peer with people and get V6 access that way. But, recently we got a V6 enabled circuit directly to our front door from a local ISP. And that was something that 4 or 5 years ago we couldn't have done. There really was nobody offering last mile service. And today, it seems like just about everybody does that I ask. They're like, oh, yeah, we can do that. And, if you're in a data center, there's almost no doubt that you can find somebody that can give you V6 transit in some way, shape, or form. It's gotten really easy, actually.
Jan or Greg, would you say it's kind of the same situation in Europe?
I would, although if you do a trace route or something like this, you would sometimes find that your packets take a different path than over V6 or over V4. So the topology of the later topology of the V6 network is not necessarily the same, of course. The second thing is, I'm sure that we are not at the point when all the providers or even the transit or core providers would actually be, let's say, have the same level of knowledge about V6 as V4. So you can expect perhaps that the V6 networks or the paths would be a little bit less stable. That's one of the reasons I think that Google, the www.google.com is not reachable over V6. You have to go to ipv6.google.com. to actually arrive at their site. And when I was at a lecture by those guys who set up the Google website over V6, they actually said they have like 4 or 5% of clients who are not able to fully establish sessions with them over V6. So there is still a little bit of a problem globally, I guess, with some users perhaps not being able to get to your site for various reasons. Could be client misconfigurations, could be issues on the network path, so on and so on. So perhaps it's perhaps a wise idea that if you're currently automatically setting up a site, which would be, for example, visible to your users, to perhaps use a different host name for that particular site. So not to share your, let's say, www.company.com site on both the V4 and V6 address, but have a different V6 site, at least until those issues get ironed out. But I think those things will pretty much disappear in the short term, although it's perhaps nice to know that the quality of the V4 network is perhaps a little bit better currently than the quality of the V6 network globally.
Mm. I think that's related to the fact that service providers who've rolled out IPv6 have just slammed it in, and all their monitoring tools and their quality, you know, the front desk, you know, where faults are, and there's so few people who've got IPv6, they're not ringing up saying IPv6 is down, so they're not fixing those problems. So it's otherwise it's still very difficult to get a provider for me to get someone to give me IPv6 at this point in time.
You know, one of the stories that I've heard from a lot of providers is that it's very easy for them to turn on IPv6. You know, going dual stack, it's very easy. Turning it on your router, your host, stuff like that, it's no problem. However, their provisioning systems don't support IPv6 addresses, so they have these database backends and other things that actually go out and provision their routers for them, and they can't actually type in a V6 address in there. So they get, you know, they could do it manually, but they can't do it through their billing systems and whatnot, which means that, you know, it's hard for them to actually deploy this to customers and make any money from it. So there's this big holdup because of that. It's not necessarily the network technology that's lacking. It's the business tools that are in use.
And the CPE and the set-top box, those are the issues for the providers. So it's very easy if you're a business user, you have a Ethernet or an optical connection, that shouldn't be a problem, like doing a BGP session and all that stuff. But if you're a residential user, providers typically will not have a set-top box ready for you or a CPE ready for you, like a home router, which would reliably support IPv6 and be properly configured by the ISP.
One of the things that we've been talking about here that kind of led to our discussion of just how connected is the IPv6 global internet was the topic of BGP, and you know, we'd been talking about routing protocols in general. So, okay, I am advertising my IPv6 block via BGP to my ISP, which is going to be advertised for globally connected internet. In the IPv4 world, summarization for BGP was absolutely huge because there's so many prefixes out there in the internet. We're just killing routers with 300,000 plus routes in the IPv4 internet. So is summarization, whether it's BGP to the internet or whether it's internal on your enterprise, is that still a pretty common technique that's done?
I would say that, of course, that's the technique that we want to still do. But if you look at the number of IPv6 prefixes in the global routing table, it's extremely low at this point. So it is definitely not comparable to the number of IPv4 prefixes. And I think it will take a while before we start worrying about this. Again, it has the potential to explode, definitely. So summarization is absolutely nice, proper behavior internally or externally. So again, it influences the conversion. The internal routing protocols, like the OSPF's calculation, which is still bound by the number of routes. So yeah, the answer is yes, but currently, again, it is really impossible to compare the size of the V4 and the V6 global routing table. It's just a huge difference.
Yeah, but that's a technique that hasn't been replaced by any sort of IPv6 functionality. It's still something that we all got to keep in mind. We still got to deal with it and summarize as a best practice, whether it's internal or external. So, okay, fair enough. Thinking back to the enterprise space then, a lot of us have used access lists for any number of things, whether it's just basic security and interface or defining interesting traffic, that kind of thing. What do we do with, and is the IPv6 access list look radically different from an IPv4? And then what about prefix lists also? I've as far as doing things like setting up a route filtering or defining which routes I'm going to redistribute, I much prefer prefix lists to access lists because they're easier to write and more flexible. Do you have such a thing as an IPv6 prefix list?
Well, in my experience, at least here at Aaron, we use access control lists on Cisco routers in a very limited sense. We prefer to filter on firewalls. But where we do have access control lists, they pretty much work just the same on V6 as they do on V4. The biggest problem is if you filter ICMP or, that some of the behaviors of V6 in the way the protocol works means that you can't do the exact same kind of filtering on your routers that you do on V4. ICMP is a great example. For instance, the way fragmentation works on IPv6, it relies heavily on ICMP packets to be sent from the host to advertise if a packet's too big or too small and what the MTU should be for a packet. If you filter all of your ICMP at the edge, you won't be able to fragment packets, and that means packets are going to get lost. It's one of the big issues we've seen when talking to other networks and people that can't get to our website. They have ACLs in place or firewall rules that are filtering ICMP, and they can't get there. So it's not so much of a technical problem of the ACLs looking different. It's more of a administrative problem of making sure that while trying to maintain parity between V4 and V6 ACLs, that you don't filter things in V6 that you shouldn't be filtering, or vice versa. You don't let things through that you shouldn't either. So,
all right, Jan had alluded to that earlier, where if you filter the wrong ICMP message, all of a sudden you've broken your local device functionality, his ability to discover neighbors and so on.
Oh, yeah, and it extends into, you know, being able to talk to remote networks. If there's any path into discovery involved in the process, you can break that very easily as well. And, you know, it's just something to be aware of. You know, so it's not that the ACLs really look any different or behave any differently. It's that the protocols have differences in the way that they behave. And you need to be aware of those when you construct your ACLs. But really not a big deal.
I've got an idea that later versions of iOS actually by default pass certain types of ICMP, even on certain conditions. So you may have to read the documentation for Cisco iOS, where I think in iOS 15 they actually allow neighbor discovery ICMP packets or automatically go through the access list so that it works as you would expect. You don't have to specifically define them. But what Ryan's saying there is correct, in that PMTUD you would probably have to configure that manually for PMTUD discovery.
Yeah, that's actually absolutely correct. So iOS, if you don't do a deny IP any at the end, it will automatically permit neighbor discovery at the beginning, invisibly, right? So the moment you do a deny IP any, it also denies all ICMP. But if you forget
deny
IP any, then it permits the neighbor discovery kind of implicitly.
And prefix lists, I assume, are there, and you can just write a prefix list for IPv6 like you would have for IPv4? I was thinking about route redistribution particularly, but that maybe is not a big component in IPv6 yet.
I think all the standard practices from V4 apply here, so there's no big difference here.
Yeah, okay. Well, on a more practical side, let's talk about some of the network devices that are out there that people are commonly going to have deployed in their enterprise networks. And what would we say are truly IPv6 ready? And some of this we've talked about already. You know, Windows XP to a degree, you know, Vista and 7, it gets better. Linux, it's been around for a while. The same thing with the various flavors of the Mac operating system. Jan, you were saying routers from Cisco, iOS version has been around for a long time, and support and functionality continues to grow and evolve. Not mature yet, but there for sure. What about Juniper? Anybody have experience with Juniper, JunOS stuff?
Yeah, unfortunately, my experience with Juniper is somewhat light, though. My understanding is that JunOS has supported IPv6 for a very, very long time, and it does it very well. I just have very limited experience with it.
And then that's my understanding. Yeah, I agree. That's my understanding as well.
Yeah, we got. I've noticed. I do a lot of work with F5 load balancers. I've noticed that there is an IPv6 stack there. I haven't spent time yet to get it configured and sort out what the limitations are. Whether you can do, full proxy functionality in an F5 box like you can at IPv4 with IPv6 or not. You guys had any opportunity to work on F5 stuff?
Yeah, I have not worked on F5. I've worked on some Foundry and Brocade equipment, and there is a lack of parity between V4 and V6 when it comes to load balancer features, unfortunately. We've actually been working with Brocade on their ADX platform and trying to get some V6 features added, which they've been receptive, and they're updating their code to give us some of the functionality we need. So, for instance, we're looking for things like GSLB over V6 and SSL acceleration over V6, and that stuff, it's in the works. Hopefully we'll have it soon. But yeah, right now, anyways, there does appear to be a lack of feature parity, at least in commercial products. I know that the Linux virtual server stuff, if you use that for a load balancer sort of function, its V6 support is actually pretty good. And so is OpenBSD's. If you use RelayD and OpenBSD, you can do a lot of that kind of stuff. in V6, and it works just fine.
I suspect F5, and I know that none of the Cisco load balancers have IPv6 support yet, and I suspect that's to do with the silicon acceleration that they're using in the forwarding engines that cause problems. However, one thing to note is that IPv6 on load balancers is a way of doing the inverse of what I spoke earlier about proxies for outbound, is that if you have IPv4 addressing on your servers, you can present, and providing you're using TCP termination features on your load balancers. So in F5 speak, it's called TCP, TCP One Connect, where the load balancer actually terminates the TCP session and then opens a new session back to the web servers or the load balance servers themselves. In the ACE, they call it session termination and so forth. And that would imply that you've got SSL offload on and the boxes and all that sort of thing. But you can present an IPv6 address from the load balancer forward to the internet, terminate the connection on your load balancer, and then run IPv4 addresses to your web servers or your hosted servers that you're looking at, whether they be email, FTP. And that is another way of actually presenting IPv6 addressing to the internet, but handling IPv4 addressing in the back end. It's not perfect, but it may do for a short period of time as a transition strategy while you light up your front end with IPv6 and then start to move IPv6 down the stack of your web servers and then down into your database servers and so forth.
Yeah, that's a good idea. You know, and you could do something very similar using Cisco's and 6-4, you know, right on the router to host. We did that for a while with some of our DNS servers in production.
It gives you a progressive map. You start at the router, and then you do the firewall, and then you do the load balancer, and then you do the servers, and you can stabilize each part, or you know, focus on those features until they're all stable and move down the stack.
Well, you kind of stepped right into another interesting topic here, which is in an enterprise network, particularly if you've got a large enterprise and you're trying to connect different offices, bringing up IPv6 one at a time, there may be an IPv4 wide area that you're required to use. You can't get IPv6 natively across that because your carrier doesn't offer it yet. Is there a best practice design that people are typically using today to bridge that gap, to get from the IPv6, the two IPv6 offices across that IPv4 infrastructure? We had talked earlier about how some of the tunneling techniques are changing and some of the NAT strategies are changing. As of today, what's the best way you'd attack that problem?
Well, I think, you know, tunnels are certainly an option. You know, there's a somewhat new strategy for overlaying V6 networks on top of V4 networks where you don't necessarily have V6 support everywhere, called 6RD, which was, I think, Freenet in France. They did a widespread deployment of this to V6 enable their end users. And effectively what it is it's kind of a new take on 6-4 that allowed them to use 6-4 type of methodology and technology to deploy V6 on the edges of their network and kind of skip the middle where they didn't have V6 support at all by wrapping things inside of 6-4. But I think also certainly tunnels are a great answer as well.
Yeah, wouldn't you have MTU problems in that environment? Because the IPv6 packet can get significantly larger than an IPv4 packet. If you're running something like a GRE overlay, you'd have MTU issues, I would have thought.
Well, I think that's certainly true, and it depends on the application as to whether or not that will cause you performance penalty or not. You know, if it's video or something that's, you know, requires real time sort of packet transfers, it could certainly cause you problems. But for a lot of just general enterprise network loads, in my experience, it actually worked quite well.
Yeah, I would tend to agree. I would definitely prefer tunnels, although they have MTU issues, but those MTU issues are typically easily resolved because most of the properly configured devices should basically participate in path M2 discovery or should be able to work with end-to-end path discovery of IPv6. I really want to perhaps stress the difference between, let's say, tunneling your IPv6 over V4, let's say GRE or IPsec VTI or something like this, compared to doing NAT. Because if you're doing 6-4 NAT, any form of 6-4 NAT, you're basically interconnecting two different philosophies of fragmentation and reassembly. And this is hell to troubleshoot. So if you do translation gateways like iOS 6-4 NAT, basically if you start having fragmentation problems or path M2 discovery problems, they are much easier to resolve in a tunnel world than a world which translates between one fragmentation philosophy to another fragmentation philosophy on a single box and tries to resolve the two different philosophical approaches to fragmentation. So tunnels are the way to go for me, and NAT is the way to avoid for that kind of a side-to-side scenario.
Hmm. So tunneling is then your favorite trick, Alan, would you say?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, okay.
Tunneling the duct tape of the internet.
Absolutely.
Well, guys, I think it will be for some time, too,
yeah. Everybody loves GRE tunnels. We love them so much, they actually Cisco had to put them in hardware to make them work because we used them all the time. One other thing to note is I've been trying to research IPv6 forwarding performance for data centers. And trying to investigate, you know, we talk about IPv4 forwarding performance in terms of 15 million packets per second, but the IPv6 packet is twice the size of an IPv4 packet. Does that mean that the forwarding performance is about, you know, what's the difference? And I think my current rough rule of thumb is that it's half. Because the TCP/IP header is twice the size of an IPv4 header, it takes that much longer to get through the silicon, if the silicon's going to support it, in fact, at all. Generally, most of the modern switches can support IPv6 forwarding at line rate, but the actual routing performance is about half as what the IPv4 is because the packet's twice the size, or the header is twice the size, more correctly. At least that's my understanding.
I would say it all depends on the TKM architecture and the buffer size that you have available. So I would say that you can easily build a platform that can have the same performance of IPv4 and IPv6. But I think what most vendors are trying to do is basically fit IPv6 in the silicon which was designed for IPv4, and that might have limitations, so like double lookups in the TKM table or something like that. Perhaps one thing which is worth stressing is also devices which have like a fast path and a slow path. So you have a silicon path and you have some kind of a CPU, generic CPU path. Some vendors who have older architectures, for example, say we support V6, but they will support it in the software path, and you will have orders of magnitude of lower performance of V6 compared to V4. So again, we can talk about, let's say, 50% degradation, or we can talk about like 99% degradation in some cases.
Ooh. Yeah. So beware if you're trying to do high performance stuff in the data center is what I think the summary of that is.
Definitely something to ask the vendors. I think that Jan hinted at something just then that people have not been designing equipment to pass V6 traffic, and it's something that they're really just starting to do now. You know, a lot of the support that you see in products, it was tacked on to something that was designed, you know, quite a few years ago. The life cycle for something to be designed by a Cisco or a Juniper is many years, and it takes them time to actually get something in silicon that is optimized for V6. But I think that we'll also start seeing that, and you know, if not in the immediate future, in the next couple of years, you'll start to see things that probably perform better doing V6 than they do over V4, because that's what they were optimized to do.
Cisco's Nexus switch, as you say, was 10 years ago.
Yeah.
The original planning for that was 10 years ago, so certainly it can be many, many years.
Hey, guys, this has been a really, really great discussion, really informative. Is there anything else in the IPv6 realm, points that you want to make, or things that the listeners should know as we're thinking about this?
Well, one thing which is interesting, perhaps, is that the readiness of your applications is of paramount importance. So we are talking about the network. We know that the core of our network, or the basic switching and routing mechanisms, work pretty much okay. Their services like firewalls, IPSs, work, let's say, to a certain degree. But you really have to think about your applications. Most people have this idea that IPv6 is completely independent of the applications, which is absolutely incorrect. Just imagine your application handling an IPv4 address, putting it in a certain database, writing it to a log file. What will happen when an IPv6 address appears in that place? And in our experience, we have seen applications break horribly when they ran over IPv6, although they were supposedly independent of the underlying transport. So the moment an application handles an IP address in its logs or anywhere in its let's say application payload or processing, you will typically have issues migrating to V6 with that particular application.
Rule of thumb being then, as you're going through the process of your IPv6 rollout, you need to benchmark and test functionality of all your business critical applications, because it isn't an automatic that it's just going to work. It may not.
Absolutely, and yeah. Even things which you would be certain that they work, for example, a network-based application like the TechX Plus client inside the Cisco iOS would break because it is not designed to take the IPv6 caller ID and pass it to your Radius or TechX Plus server. So it will your authentication will stop working when you actually want to access a network device, that kind of application as well, not only the, let's say, business-critical applications which would typically run on servers, although you will have problems on all those areas.
And don't forget little things like your syslog scripts on your Linux server. And you've probably got regexes all set up for IPv4 address matching, and then suddenly you've got IPv6 addresses.
Yeah, you know, at Aaron, the greatest challenge to deploying V6 wasn't getting it on the network and getting hosts talking it. It was updating our scripts and our, you know, our Nagios monitoring stuff, all this custom stuff that we've developed over the years that wasn't V6 ready. And yeah, as you said, updating regexes and other things to get that to work. There was an incredible amount of work there. Yeah. You know, none of it's not hard stuff, but it can be very time consuming. And it's one of those things that it's kind of an afterthought. You're like, oh, this script is broken. I wonder why. And you go and look and like, oh, yeah, of course. It's not V6 ready.
Yep. Anything else that we wanted to add?
Go and do it.
Yeah, exactly. The only thing I'd like to say is that, you know, don't be afraid of V6. It's really not that hard. You know, getting it on the network is, frankly, it's the easy part. It's getting it up the stack into the applications and stuff like that where things can get a little bit more interesting. But it's certainly, it's very easy to get in there and get your feet wet.
Yeah, and Matt, I mean, it's not that long. I mean, I think an article I saw recently said roughly the middle of 2011, and there won't be any more IPv4 allocations that the rears can do for anyone. We will be out, and then it'll be whatever your ISP's got left is what you're going to get, and it's going to be disappearing quickly after that. So, I mean, time really and truly is of the essence here, so the sooner we get familiar with it before there's a gun to our head, the better.
Yeah. I think that IANA will allocate its last V4 addresses sometime next year, and the RIRs will follow soon after. And, you know, once V4 is gone, it's really gone. I think, you know, there will be possibly some market, and, you know, V4 will be around for a while, but if you aren't playing with V6 now or in the very near future, you're putting yourself or your business at a disadvantage.
Yeah, and as a network guy, there's no reason not to, because we've made the point on the show here that you can set up a IPv6 layout for your network and start to roll it out to routers and so on and begin testing, and then as you, over time, get your applications running on it. There's nothing really stopping the network guys from getting moving.
No. You know, and we started very slowly. You know, it's been about 7 years or so that we've been running V6 here, and we started with a very small, very experimental network, taking baby steps. We didn't even dual stack at first. We were afraid to. And as we got more comfortable, we just kept adding things, and before we knew it, it was running on our backbone, and then it was everywhere. So, you know, once you get comfortable with it, and you kind of learn, oh, this is really just V4 with longer addresses, it's really not that hard. And certainly nothing to be afraid of. So, yeah, jump in.
And I would just perhaps like to add, this is your opportunity to do things right from the beginning. So we all know there are best practices for V4, but we also know we have terrible kludges in our networks. So the topology is not right, the routing is not right in some places. When going to V6, you just have to keep your layer 2 topology. You have to keep the VLANs the same, but you can have a totally different layer 3 topology. You can do routing in a different way, right? Like you always wanted to do in IPv4. You can put a firewall someplace and route V6 traffic through it and route V4 traffic on its normal path. So you can do things completely different from a layer 3 perspective and do, again, design your dream network properly from the start. This is your chance. And if you blow this, then in 5 years you will say, well, we had a chance and we blew it when we deployed IPv6. So think about the best practices of V4, translate them to V6 and do things right from the beginning.
I think people should be thinking about getting started. Find a corner of your network, plug it in, and then start finding out what's not working. Things like your NetFlow export software isn't ready for IPv6, and so you've got to go and start looking at that, or your syslog daemon's not ready for IPv6, or your TACAX isn't ready for IPv6, and you just start working away, chipping away at those, identify all those things and make a big list, and then start a project which generally just chips away at those over time until you know those things are all ready, and then you're ready to actually start executing IPv6 in your network. Certainly possible to have a lab network with this type of stuff in it where you could actually start playing with that. Integrate it into your live systems. There's nothing wrong with putting an IPv6 router and then integrating it with your TACX server and seeing how that goes.
Yeah, it's the technique that I want to take as well, is just to get started with it, get it rolling on my devices that can support it, figure out what operating systems need to be upgraded, what can do it, get it rolled, and then bring up some routing adjacencies and just start playing with it to get it going. My goal is to understand it well enough and have other guys I work with understand it well enough so that when the business demands it, we have a business need for IPv6, we've done all the hard work. We know that, you know, we've got a connected infrastructure that's already running IPv6, and we don't have to go, give us 6 months to play with it, and we'll hopefully have something back for you. We can say, yeah, we're most of the way ready to go already. Let's go. And that's what I'm hoping to make happen where I'm at today. So, yeah. Well, guys, I want to thank you for joining us. This has been a great Absolutely great discussion. I really appreciate it. And Matt, just one more time, you want to tell us if there's a blog you've got, or are you on Twitter or any of those neat social networking things where people can follow you and stay in touch? Or
Sure. On Twitter, I'm Ryan Zach, and you can follow me there. I have a personal blog at plantfood.org/blog. Again, I'll mention the Team Aaron website, which is a great resource for what's going on at Aaron, especially if you're interested in V4 depletion and V6 adoption issues. That's really the place to go. There is so much information that is passed along through that website that you will you'll have your finger on the pulse of what's going on at Aaron.
Beautiful, Jan.
Well, definitely you can visit our website, www.nil.com, and also, of course, we have a blog called Fragments, and of course, one of the founders of our company, Ivan Pipelniak, has a blog called iOS Hints, when he also frequently talks about IPv6. So those are cool pointers if you want to expand your IPv6 horizons.
Excellent. And Mr. Farrow.
Hey. Of course, you can find me on Twitter at @etherealmind and my blog at etherealmind.com. I've been wailing on this week about the converged networking and been mulling over in my mind about what happens to our careers when VMware networking and storage starts to converge and what happens there. I'd appreciate any comments that people might have.
And, of course, I'm Ethan Banks. You can follow me on Twitter at ecbanks. I have not been blogging very much at all at packetattack.wordpress.com, but I have more articles I got to put in there. I've got a lot of great responses on when is it time to go independent, and I'm going to be compiling that and putting it up. And I had a lot of interesting comments on the article I wrote about just fundamentals of spanning tree design, which is kind of a funny thing for people to get excited about since all the rage these days is talking about making spanning tree go away. But anyway, I think I'll probably expand that a bit more, as a lot of people had questions and thoughts on it. And of course, packetpushers.net is the Packet Pushers podcast website, and you can also follow us on Twitter @packetpushers. So until next time, remember that too much networking would never